On this matter, several of us have been talking over the past couple of weeks about the movement of communism in so many nations in Africa, South America.
Yeah.
Now, which type of communism is this, Bill? And do you see it moving very strongly in these areas? I think we're kind of blind to it.
It is. Well, I got to give you a kind of a two-sided answer. Number one is it tends to be a kind of unique communism in the various situations. And it tends to be that way largely due to the effect of Mao and of Tito. Because there's a kind of a general realization outside of the Soviet Union in their kind of approach to things, which is monolithic. There's a kind of a general consensus that communism develops differently in different sorts of environments. Now, tomorrow I'm going to be talking a bit, assuming we get done today with this business. I should apologize, you're getting kind of bits and pieces as we're going along here, because yesterday and today what I've been trying to do is to give you a lot of stuff so that we get a kind of a common ground in which we can talk. And that's always kind of frustrating when you're handing out stuff and you can't do it in a coherent, organized kind of way. Well, at any rate, largely as a result of the influence of Mao, there's a general kind of agreement among non-Russian communists that communism develops uniquely in different kinds of situations, and that it's necessary to have a great amount of autonomy locally, so that the French Communist Party no longer takes orders from Moscow, and the Italian Communist Party no longer takes orders from Moscow. And down in Africa and in Asia, you know, there's a kind of an autonomy operative there. We have tended to do the same thing in Christianity. You know, where we operate in terms of what we call indigenous ministry. See, and it's not only the white man can bring the message of salvation, and so the white man goes all around the world and he gives the message of salvation, you know, and the native can't. No way. You know, maybe he can work for the white man, but the white man is the, you know, to be a clergyman, you got to be white and preferably American. See, that idea is gone. And when we go into a country, we attempt to develop an indigenous ministry as soon as possible there. Well, we started before the communists did. But this is the sort of thing that they're doing, and it's largely due to Mao. Another factor that's involved there is the notion of wars of national liberation that I'll end up with today if we get done. And this is from Mao, that communism will spring up all over the place. And it is the obligation of comrades to assist their comrades elsewhere in the world to liberate themselves from archaic forms of government. But it doesn't mean that you come in and take over. See, or that the China sends an army to North Vietnam or to South Vietnam to enable it to free itself of United States imperialism or something of that sort, you know, to use their kind of terms. You send a little red book around to give people ideas of how they can be freer than they are. You may send some money. You may send some business experts. You may send a guerrilla tactician, a guy who knows how to liberate a country. But that's about the extent of it. And the basic secret of Mao is self-realization. You know, I talked the first day about you put a guerrilla group together and you train them in guerrilla tactics and you hand them a little bag of rice that's good for about 3 days and you say, good luck. See, and they go out and make it on their own. And so there's this kind of thing also on spreading communism around the world, which is a kind of self-achievement sort of thing. And it's not the great big organized network of the Comintern or something like that, which was the Russian model, and which, you know, which failed miserably, never got anywhere. And but the Chinese model of Mao is being relatively successful, and it pops up in the most unexpected places, because it's, at least initially, it's a guerrilla movement, and it's largely underground. And so, of course, it's much more difficult to combat. Yes?
I was just wondering how this would fit in with what was happening on campuses, say in the late 60s. You know, problems that really generated because of things that were going on the campus, and then sort of mushroomed into something else because there were lots of non-students involved, lots of instigators going on.
All right, a number of things involved there. I saw the 60s campus unrest from a prof standpoint, you know, not from a student standpoint. So I have to add that, you know, as a preface to what I'm going to say. Number one, to some extent, the 1960s unrest was, we got a protest because our European fellow students are protesting too. And at times, some of the things that were being protested against didn't make any sense. But they made perfectly good sense over in Europe. But there was a kind of a worldwide, you know, the thing to do was to protest. And as a result of an awful lot of travel around the world by students, you know, they were real wanderers through the late 50s and much of the 60s. As a result of this wandering around, there was a kind of infeeling that developed among students. To be, if you were a student, you know, you identified with any student anywhere in the world. And so there was a kind of a commonality of behavior that began to emerge. And so the thing to do was to protest. I remember when we had a protest on our campus, and I talked to a couple of the kids that had organized it, and I asked them why they were protesting. Well, you know, you don't have a decent campus unless you had a good protest. You know, and you call up the newspapers ahead of time to let them know protest is scheduled at time so and so, and we are going to get very angry about the way we're being mistreated or something like that. So there was a certain element of that. It was the thing to do. Then it got a militant response, and you know, and so then it became for real, and it continued until Kent State, and Kent State ended it. And Kent State ended it for the very simple reason that American students discovered that American students are not immortal. See, you can get killed protesting, and that ended it.
You know, that almost sounds a little too folksy, a reason for protest that went on, at least in the Bay Area. You know, in Berkeley, at San Francisco State, there were people who knew exactly what they were doing and came in from one campus to another.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then were gone.
Yeah.
And then they
and went, oh, sure.
And I just don't see the motive being comradeship with your fellow students who are protesting, let's help them get theirs off the ground. There was something else going on.
Oh, yeah, I just given you one of about six facets I'm going to give you. See, I mean, so that's not the whole answer. All right. Number two, I think that American universities had started to get sort of inbred. And European universities were considerably more inbred and traditional than American universities were. And so consequently, you took a curriculum because you were told that was the curriculum, whether you saw any purpose for it or not. American students that were coming along at that time had been raised with, let's say, considerably more attention to their own likes and dislikes than the previous generation, with the result that where the previous generation tolerated this and didn't complain, this generation didn't. And I said, I don't see any purpose in doing this, and I'm not going to do it. They also discovered that if one person says this, it's an easy way to get kicked out of college. But if 100 people say it, they aren't going to get kicked out of college. See, so they began to discover that mass behavior works. Well, they learned that from the Japanese, you know, from the Japanese students who organized, you know, the gangs and locked arms together and marched around and, you know, and with the cadence marching and the cadence chanting and so on. And they discovered that they could disrupt. And if there were enough of them, they could get away with it. See? And so then certain strategies begin to emerge. Well, then you get other groups beginning to attach themselves to this. You get disaffected people begin to attach themselves to this. You get some nuts do. The communists certainly thought this was terrific, you know, and some of the people that were from Berkeley on that were always trying to get a piece of the action was the Young Communist League, which never ever really got off the ground. One of the most pathetic student groups I ever saw was the Young Communist League at the University of Chicago, where they used to come around and plead with people to please come to their meetings. You know, and then all of a sudden, they just sort of got overwhelmed by a couple other student organizations that came along. So there was just a kind of a revolutionary fervor that began to develop. And students were highly mobile, other people were highly mobile, and they could get from one place to another. And then one other facet that I think is extremely significant and underrated is the invention of the bullhorn. So that you could instantly be big voiced. You can I don't know of a single student activist leader of the 50s who had a big voice. You know, that could holler like a bull. But you take the bullhorn. All right, now hear that, we know that. You know, all of a sudden you're bigger than life. See, and you are a leader of men because you are holding the bullhorn and you can outshout anybody in sight because you've got a bigger voice than they have. Now this had a fantastic effect. One of the fascinating things about some of these big protests was the leaders were in the rear. You think that they had been trained at West Point. Yeah. They stood in the rear. All right, now let's advance on the police. Watch it up ahead there, you know. And the leaders were way at the back, you know, and sending orders up ahead to the naive ones up in the front line who were battling the police. And then when they lost, you know, they hopped into the fast car and disappeared. You know, those are the ones you were talking about before. And there were people who made a profession of leading demonstrations. Yeah. You know, and they'd go from one campus to another, and wherever they went, you knew there was going to be trouble. So there was a certain element of that also. There were some people that simply got their kicks out of that. And burning of buildings got to be a fad. And there was a certain percentage of the student body that felt that you couldn't really be proud of your university unless a building had been burned down there. And so you just sort of had a duty to your alma mater to burn a building down. And so, you know, some of this kind of thing happened. Now there also was, there were all kinds of tensions relative to the Vietnam situation that got sublimated and expressed in the early days of Vietnam in certain strange kind of ways. And, you know, I say that because I'm one of the few people who was very anti-Vietnam in the Eisenhower years, when nobody was against Vietnamese involvement. And really the strong protests against Vietnam emerged for young people, the alternatives got to be fight in Vietnam or go to college. See, and it got increasingly phony, and then he got all kinds of weird things happening. Like for a couple of years, well, we used to have a weird thing that got replaced by another weird thing. That was on the subject of student marriage. Now, about 1955, ours is a church-owned college, and they go out and work professionally for the church. Female students were not permitted to become engaged until Easter of their senior year. And then only with the permission of the dean of students.
Hold on to love life.
Okay, you see how times have changed. Well, I mean, you just program it. And all of a sudden, what began to happen during Vietnam was that the students discovered a thing called deferment because of dependence. And all of a sudden, we got gobs of girls of sophomore high school age seeking some young man whom they could save from the draft by means of marriage. And all of a sudden we get millions of teenage marriages. Because they loved one another? No. To escape the draft. And the girl entered into marriage for patriotic reasons. And then all of a sudden we got, gobs of divorces. Well, you could have predicted that was going to happen. Well, all of a sudden, we got all kinds of kids applying to our college that are already married. What are you going to do now? What happens to our, you can't get engaged until you... Well, you can take two alternatives. You can stick to your principal and say, well, gee, we sure love to have you, but we have this rule, and so you better apply somewhere else. Or you can change the rule. Well, when it's a question of population and students, make the difference between having a college and not having a college, you change the rules, which we did, as did everybody else that had a marriage rule. See, you can't get married while you're in college. It was a pretty general rule. It wasn't just because of church vocations and things like that. All the way in the 30s, it finally got so that it was beginning to seem halfway normal to have women at college. See, that's how recent that sort of thing is. And then, but you couldn't have marriage or thoughts of marriage because it interfered with studies, and those pretty girls that were on campus only to catch a man, they were not to be allowed to distract the men from the real reason why they were there, namely to get an education. And so we had marriage rules to see to it that the women that we really didn't want on campus didn't interfere with the real reason why the men were there. So, it took a long while to get rid of that kind of stuff. but that was a factor that was involved in the situation also. And then finally we reached a point where we had a pretty strong national paranoia. And we reached a point where there was kind of a general schizophrenic condition where you know, you had a new rumor a week and a new version of reality a week. And then a kind of a final factor was the television business, and that was like the bullhorn business. That television camera could zoom in on you, you know, and with your face contorted in anger and screaming and so on, and boy, you really looked important. Now, if that camera pulled back on the zoom and saw that you were screaming, hollering to four people, see, all of a sudden you didn't look too important, but as long as it came in and did a headshot on you, boy, you might have been talking to 10,000 people and stirring up a frenzy. And particularly if they build up the decibels on their mic that was picking up audience sounds, you know, boy, it really sounded like it was a monstrous throng that you were haranguing. So we all of a sudden have instant celebrities. We had instant celebrities in show business, and we had instant celebrities in activism. See, Stokely Carmichael comes along, and H. Rapp Brown come along, and all of a sudden they're big dealers. See, and so the television influence came there, and we didn't know how to handle television. We're still learning how to handle television, because it creates artificial realities that aren't really there. See?
So that doesn't really fit into your idea of how now communism would spread.
I doubt, and I haven't seen anywhere that there is much of any evidence that there was any support at all. Now, I think that both the FBI and the CIA found that there was no financial support to any of the student activism in the United States or much anywhere else. That a lot of this was autonomous within the nation. And I suspect that anybody that hangs around students realize that students are able to survive on virtually nothing anyway. And, you know, you never live so cheaply as when you're a college student. And you never are able to any time after that, or to go back to that. But at any rate, students live very cheaply. And, so, you know, they didn't need infusion of large amounts of money from the Soviet Union or from Communist China. So to a great extent, this was not communist-inspired. Wherever the communists did come in, they tended not to have any ideological effect, or much of any ideological effect, with certain limitations. But where they were most important and most valuable to student activists was on strategy techniques. See, and they learned their strategy techniques from the Maoists. And they read the Little Red Book to learn strategy. But they were working with different kinds of values. And so the name of the game became strategy. And you never debated or questioned values. Your values came preset. You believed in them. You never challenged them. The name of the game was, what kind of strategy can you use to succeed? And so the whole debate was about means, and Mao had developed all kinds of techniques. Spent 30 years studying technique, how to succeed. And one of the fascinating things about that time was the biggest Broadway musical at the time was Robert Morris's smash hit, you know, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which was about technique too. The technique of success in the business world. And then the Peter books came out, showing the Peter principle and so on. You know, the whole game of survival in the business jungle. And the whole game became technique. I think today we're starting to talk about ultimate values and what's worthwhile and what's not worthwhile. But for almost 20 years, all that we engaged in was strategy and counter-strategy. And you had, you remember the name, the non-negotiable demand time? See? You remember non-negotiable demands? where you come in and you lay your non-negotiable demands down on the table. Well, there was considerably more psychological significance to that than appeared at first glance, because it wasn't only that was non-negotiable. Your protesters weren't about to discuss their values. You know, they were rigid, unchallengeable. And they tended to run into people who were also non-negotiable. So then all of a sudden it becomes very fashionable to talk about confrontation. And we solve problems by confrontation. You know, billy goats solve problems by confrontation. You know, and heads get split. Well, then that finally gave way to reconciliation. See, which is a workable way of problem solving. Confrontation isn't. See, and so you got confrontation with the various authority groups, confrontation with the police, so on. And you confronted presidential candidates and that sort of thing. And got extremely powerful, you know, to such an extent that the people who were protesting repression got repressive. As soon as anybody showed up on a college campus to talk on an unpopular topic, you shut him up by confrontation. Even at Harvard University. See? And then all of a sudden everybody started getting shook. You know, what has... You know, if the name of the game is confrontation, then you can forget some of the old ideas like goodness and truth and so on. And it's just every man for himself. And if it's every man for himself, then really there's nothing that's worth anything. And so we're kind of in the process of pulling back from that whole business and trying to sort everything out again and figure out what's worthwhile and what wasn't. And a lot of things have been changed. Now, I said before, with one exception, I think that Mao has been extremely influential, together with the Israelis, in the business about the status of women. And I'll hope I... I hope I get that, at least that far today, where I talk about some of Mao's comments about the status of women. And those are, I think, probably the most radical ideas in terms of Mao's own culture that Mao expressed, were his ideas about the status of women. Because the Oriental idea of the status of woman is probably second only to the Arab conception of the status of woman. It's pretty low. And Mao advocated equality. That's a radical move.
What did he advocate?
Equality. Equality for women. You know, that's a radical step to take. Now, I mention the Israelis because, you know, I guess it's common knowledge that in the state of Israel there's male-female equality. Women are drafted in the army, women fight in the trenches, and so on. You know, and it's not, you know, the girls serve as nurses and make up the band-aids and the boys go out and get wounded. But, you know, they fight side by side and they drive trucks side by side and things like that. In the Soviet Union, they tended to practice equality in the intellectual groups. And so you get women doctors, women scientists, and so on. As a matter of fact, most of the MDs in the Soviet Union are women. But also the profession of MD is not one of the highest professions as it is in the United States. It's considered sort of second-class profession. And so it doesn't bother, and that's why it's mostly women that are in it. The physical sciences and some of the other research sciences are largely men, although there are a lot of women there. Mathematics.
There's a lot of women geologists, mostly.
Right. But then you get down to the bottom level type job, street sweeping and this sort of thing, who does it? Women. Women. See? So, you know, there's certain things going on in the Soviet Union too, although on paper it says, you know, we pay no attention to people's sex. And most of the menial jobs in the Soviet Union are performed by women. Or the jobs that are not the highest status jobs. But in the university world, there you have a fairly general equality of opportunity. Alrighty. Yeah. The two-pronged attack to effect change, politics and war. There are two kinds of ways that you bring about social and political change in the world, politics and war. And I'll read a few other things. War is the highest form of struggle for resolving contradiction. The highest form. By this, he means it is the way of solving problems that has the largest effect, the broadest and the longest term effect. When they have developed to a certain stage between classes, nations, states, or political groups, and it has existed ever since the emergence of private property and of classes. I suspect that that last sentence is probably not true, because I could conceive that it's perfectly possible that you might have had two human beings at a level of pre-private property development that fought one another and couldn't get along with one another because it's just simply a personality conflict. So I don't think we have to blame private property for human conflict. War is the continuation of politics. In this sense, war is politics, and war itself is a political action. Politics is war without bloodshed, and war is politics with bloodshed. Now, these are two sides of the same coin. That's another famous remark. History shows that wars are divided into two kinds, just and unjust. All wars that are progressive are just. All wars that impede progress are unjust. We communists oppose all unjust wars. Well, it's nice to see they agree with us. That impede progress. But we do not oppose progressive just wars. Not only do we communists not oppose just wars, we actively participate in them. As for unjust wars, World War I is an instance in which both sides fought for imperialist interests. Therefore, the communists of the whole world firmly oppose that war, which is a dirty, stinking lie. True at all. The way to oppose a war of this kind is to do everything possible to prevent it before it breaks out. Once it breaks out, to oppose war with war, to oppose unjust war with just war, wherever possible. Revolutions, this is another quote, revolutions and revolutionary wars are inevitable in class society, and without them, it is impossible to accomplish any leap in social development. So war is necessary to achieve social development. It's a tool you use to bring about social change. And to overthrow the reactionary ruling classes, and it's therefore impossible for the people to win political power without a war. Revolutionary war is the antitoxin, which not only eliminates the enemy's poison, but also purges us of our own filth. Every just revolutionary war is endowed with tremendous power and can transform many things or clear the way for their transformation. And probably the most famous quote from Mao is, every communist must grasp this truth. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Now, unless you have the power to wage war, you don't have the power to wage peace. You negotiate from strength, as Mr. Nixon always used to say. Mr. Nixon was rather good at international relations, even if he wasn't too hot at domestic ones. And he always recognized this truth. You go to a conference from a position of strength, not from a position of weakness. Okay. That's enough quotes from that particular area. But notice that our notion of war is our traditional notion of war is that war is a state of affairs that occurs when diplomacy breaks down. In other words, the existence of a state of war is an admission that you have failed diplomatically, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a bad thing.
Would you substitute the word politically better than or diplomatically?
Yeah, in a limited...
I'm not sure it's so different then, that's what I was wondering.
Well, except from this standpoint, that if you, you know, politically, you can develop a political form of government that is based on an expansionistic principle, and so consequently, you have to engage in warfare both to keep your nation united and to expand its possessions. And so here you have a kind of situation where politics and warfare are related to one another and are not correlatives of one another. But the kind of approach which we have tended to have was that international problems are solved diplomatically. Matter of fact, we have tended to take that as a kind of truism. There is only one way to solve international problems, and that's by diplomacy. That's why we invented the United Nations as an alternative to war. War is a way whereby nations try to solve their problems when they can't solve them diplomatically. Now that's also part of our American cradle. And it is an admission that diplomacy has not worked. Now whether you're engaging in diplomacy or you're engaging in warfare, you are engaging in political activity. You know, we'd accept that also. But we take diplomacy as a good thing, war is a bad thing. Now we would agree with Mao that these are the two kinds of things that nations do in their relationships, in their political relationships with one another. They either engage in diplomatic exchange or they engage in warfare, and they don't engage in anything else politically. Economically they do, but not politically. But Mao considers these two neutral tools. And good and bad come in only in this sense, that if you are in a kind of situation where you ought to be engaging in warfare to achieve your ends and you're engaging in diplomacy instead, this is a sign of weakness and it's bad. Or where you're in a kind of situation where you can get what you want diplomatically and you go to war to get it, that's stupid. See, so good and bad is which tool you use. Whereas our viewpoint has tended to be diplomacy is a good thing to do, war is a bad thing to do. And the only time that it's just is when you're fighting a bad guy, like Adolf Hitler. See? And so these are two different notions of international relations, and what we have tended to do is to sort of naively assume that everybody agreed with us and the attitude toward diplomacy and warfare. And so at the same time,
well, that even I'm going to just say over yeah. that everybody would agree that we appear to be acting that way. I mean, it's that somebody from the outside may be interpreting our
perfect
diplomacy we do it in the event that we use it, and if we can't get our end that way, we go another way.
Yeah, I think that what has tended to be the case with a great many countries of the world in their view of the United States is. They view the United States as probably militarily still the most powerful nation on the earth. And so even when United States diplomats go around hat in hand and politely ask for things, You know, the nations that deal with us diplomatically are very much aware of the Pentagon sitting in the background, see? And so they are likely to say, look, you know, you United States, you say all you want about diplomacy and all that kind of stuff. But what really is the case is that you're wrong and Mao's wrong too. And that the difference between war and diplomacy is simply the difference between the threat and the actuality of war. And diplomacy is negotiation with the threat of war in the background, and war is actually doing it. See, and that's a third viewpoint, and I think most of the world probably has that attitude, at least about us.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering where the idea then of the Cold War or what we did in Vietnam, you know, the war, undeclared war, fighting not to win, and then playing diplomacy on one side and playing war on the other side, where does that fit in? I mean, it seems like you're saying it's either one way or the other, right? You're using diplomacy or we're using war.
All right, in Vietnam, well, Vietnam, I think, represented a kind of change of things going on. I'm having a good time, but I hope the rest of you are. Even though I have set my schedule aside. Okay, we keep on. All right, I mean, after all, you're my guests here this period, and I want you to enjoy yourself. When we were in Korea, you know, we were carrying on a 20th century tradition which began with World War I, where we were rescuing. We always tended to think of them as female countries. We always tend to think of them as female and maiden. I don't know what that says about our Freudian psyche, you know. But we always thought of countries where we were fighting as female and maiden. You know, like France, old decadent France. We always thought of her as a young female virgin. And you know, France lost her virginity about 1680. But anyway, you know, we had this kind of naive notion about, you know, we know we're the biggest kid around, so we're going to look out for all the little kids so that the bullies don't get after them, you know. So we were fighting bullies around the world. So it was the Truman Doctrine. You know, we pledged ourselves to go to the aid of any country threatened by communism. What was necessary was that the government formally request us to enter. And we tried to operate through the United Nations. We know, well, the Korea thing worked out pretty well. And we fought a limited war. You know, and we began to believe that in an atomic age with superpowers, it was possible to fight wars where you could tell the boys on the other side, or the boys that were supporting the other side, we promise scouts honor, you know, we won't cross this line here. We won't go across the Yalu River or anything else like that. So, well, Chinese didn't know us well enough, they didn't believe us, and that came down. Well, so then we got the idea that since we were so very, very powerful, we could fight war on any kind of terms. And that the world was divided into the free nations and the communist nations and their satellites. And so we just sort of jumped from Korea to Vietnam as we were going about being a Boy Scout and looking at rescuing, you know, young maidens and helping little old ladies across the street and all that. And all of a sudden we looked around in Vietnam and we were the only people there. Seeing all of our buddies had disappeared. Same thing happened in Israel, except we wised up there. And of the last war that they fought, we had a good grandstand seat, you know, where we could cheer and applaud. Sat next to the Russians, and they cheered and applauded, you know. But we just sat there and watched them fight. You know, and it didn't last very long because the Israelis, so they were on their own, and the Egyptians and the Syrians, so they were on their own, and both we and the Russians started squeezing the spigot on ammunition, and they knew they weren't going to be able to go very far, and they had to quit. See, and the Egyptians were driving like crazy to conquer Israel, and the Israelis were driving like crazy in the opposite way to conquer Egypt, You know, and I sat at my desk one day and I thought, what would happen if for the first time in history the Egyptian army conquered and totally controlled Israel and the Israeli army conquered and totally controlled Egypt? Then what do you do? And you sit in one another's capitals and say, we won. Because that's what was happening. The Israelis were barreling like crazy for Carol through the middle of the Egyptian army. The Egyptian army was barreling like crazy for Jerusalem through, you know, on both sides of the Israeli army. And it was reaching a point of absurdity. And it was going to be a gas problem because both of them were short on gasoline. And you could just see all the Israeli tanks grinding to a halt in the suburbs of Cairo. They couldn't go any further because they ran out of gas. You know, and the same thing with the Egyptians. You see, all of a sudden we started wising up and pulling back, and from that point on, the problem was, how do we get out of Vietnam? You know, the facade was kept up that we were helping these you know, these poor freedom fighters who were trying to keep from being overrun and so on. But really, the name of the game was, how do we extricate ourselves from an impossible situation? And so when Mr. Kissinger came along, Mr. Kissinger, probably better than anybody we've ever had, understood the Chinese mentality and the Chinese communist view of things. Now, Ho Chi Minh was a Maoist, an avowed Maoist, and he followed Maoist techniques. And the Viet Cong were not Maoists. Most of them probably weren't communists either. But the North Vietnamese power structure worked. And so anybody that understood the workings of Maoist communism could figure out what they were and were not going to do and what they would go for and wouldn't go for. And Mr. Kissinger did understand that. And so consequently, he was able to bring about a state of affairs where we were engaging on two levels at the same time, and in a sense contradicted Mao. So we had war going on, and we also had diplomacy going on at the very same time. Mm-hmm. Now, what we did there under Mr. Nixon with Mr. Kissinger's strategy was, we engaged in a counter strategy that was highly successful and which was unexpected on the North Vietnamese side, and that is, we engage in both at the same time. And so, then when the diplomacy surfaced at the Paris Peace Accords, then if things didn't go well at the Paris Peace Accords, we bombed Hanoi.
Yeah.
So you remember when that sort of thing went on, and then the Christmas peace offensive? See, well, that was using communist methods against them, using their techniques. And they recognized that we recognized how they operated. You know, we were on the same wavelength and we were communicating, and it wound up in a big hurry. See, but this is really the first time in the whole Vietnam mess that we were communicating. And we were getting their message and they were getting our message, and it didn't last very long after that. And then it was simply working out a kind of strategy whereby we could save face and extricate ourselves from the situation, and they understood that too, you know. And so they helped us get out, and we got out. Well, I don't know what we're going to do tomorrow. More of the same. Okay, you've been a good group.